But right now I want to welcome Michael Albert, co-founder of South End Press and Z Magazine. He's certainly been on the scene for many years, breaking new ground, challenging the status quo in a whole range of ways. Z Magazine and ZNet are certainly familiar to many of you. He's the author of Paracon, Life After Capitalism, and Looking Forward, Participatory Economics for the 21st Century, written along with Robert Hanel. Michael, thanks for being here with us tonight. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I can hear you
good.
Now.
Thank you. I wondered if you would, first of all, just say a word about your projects, because they're so important. I just want to get a word in about that first, and then we'll get to the Spanish Revolution, quote-unquote.
Well, okay. I work at what's called Z Communications. It's a magazine, Z Magazine, website, very large, elaborate website, ZNet, a video project, school, actually, that will begin in just a few days. It's in the summer, just for a couple of weeks, and some other aspects. And it's all organized around the idea of trying to provide information and vision and ideas and connections that can enhance efforts to make the world a better place.
Thank you. We'll be sure to give out some of the web addresses before we say goodnight.
Okay.
Michael, we've been reading about here in this country and all over the world about the Spanish demonstrations that had started out with just a few dozen people, picked up into tens of thousands in the Madrid Puerto del Sol Square. It started out with a lot of students, but it seems to have sparked the imagination of a lot of people that they can challenge the status quo, both in politics and economics in Spain. Huge numbers of people, sustained demonstrations, I guess a surprise to many people. But this is not in isolation. Of course, there's demonstrations in other parts of Europe where there have been the implementation of these austerity policies that have people very upset. What you want to put in perspective for us what you see going on right now in Spain?
Sure. And it isn't even just in Europe. Obviously, we had our events in Wisconsin, and I'm sure there'll be many more. The idea is relatively simple. How to describe? Imagine you live in a small community, and there's some thugs that control all the resources and have the power. But there's a kind of a standoff. You know, over time, there's been an accommodation, and most of the people in the area get some. It's just that the thugs get most of it. And then something happens. There's a shock. It could be a natural outgrowth of the way the community is organized. That's what it is in this case. Or it could be some peculiar thing, you know, a disease or whatever. What happens? Well, the thugs, the people who are in control of most of the power and most of the wealth, see such an event or such a series of events as an opportunity. They take it as a possibility, as a way, as an opportunity to use the fear of the public and the concern of the public and the pain of the public to arrive at a better situation for themselves. So what they want to do is take a crisis, the housing crisis that we know about, the financial crisis that we know about, the various crises that emerged on an international scale. They want to take that and, using the fear that people feel and the desire that people feel to escape the worst situation, they take it and they try and manipulate it. They try and choose outcomes, choose paths forward that will arrive at a position where they got even more power and even more wealth than they had before. Their intent isn't to better the lot of the poor and the weak. In fact, if you think about it, what's a crisis? A crisis is a disruption in the economy that affects the rich and the powerful. If tens of millions of people a year die of starvation, that's not a crisis. People are unemployed, that's not a crisis. It's only a crisis when it threatens profit. Then the media calls it a crisis. And then the powers that be try to solve the crisis, and they try to do it in a way that betters their own lot. Well, if the public buys that, then what you have is a situation where the public goes along with instructions from the top that says basically, look, you have to shoulder the burden, you have to get less income, you have to lose your job, you have to lose public services, and that's what happens. And the net result is that eventually the economy is righted and the great mass of people is weaker than they were before. So what's happening in Spain and in Greece, say, or it may even be larger? What's happening in these countries is that the public has decided, or at least a significant portion of the public has decided, hold on a second, the solution to this problem shouldn't be that the great bulk of us, that working people and young people and poor people, are worse off. It should be that we're better off. It should be that we not only get back to a situation in which the economy is functioning, and we not only get back to a situation in which the causes of these problems are no longer operative, but we should get back to a situation in which some justice has been attained. Maybe not as much as some of us would like, but more than we have now. And that we're better off. And so people take to the streets and they start to make demands. And what they're demanding is that we go forward in a way that isn't geared to profit the profit makers. It's geared instead to benefit those who have been on the bottom all along. And that's really what's happening. And then what happens, and you see it in Spain, you see it in Greece, you saw it before that in Argentina some years ago, what happens is the public starts to get aroused. And it might be a small event that kicks it off, say in North Africa. A particular event might kick it off. A long-standing bit of organizing might kick it off. In Egypt, that was the case. It could be that some students become aroused, and then the response kicks it off. Whatever happens, people begin to get it in their head that, wait a second, we can actually impact the situation. And that's the crucial leap that has to happen. People have to move from cynicism and despair and the belief that nothing's really possible and therefore I should just try and, you know, come through this surviving, to a belief that we can get together and do something productive here and make a situation that is beneficial for everybody instead of just for the rich.
Michael Albert, do you see the connectedness between the revolts we've seen unfold in the Middle East and North Africa and the events in Europe, in Greece, in Spain, and other locations, as well as what's happened here in Wisconsin? It seems to me that the timeline is kind of oddly coincidental or certainly related.
No, I think it's highly related, but not perhaps in exactly the way that some people might think. In other words, it isn't that the same set of conditions are hurting people in each of these places, and the same demands are propelling people in each of these places. I don't think that's the case. But what is the same is that need to transcend pessimism, that need to become hopeful and to become optimistic and to develop some confidence and wherewithal. And the reason why it happens one after another is because when in Tunisia and in Egypt, people show that it can be done. They show that, you know, you don't have to have a Ph.D., and in fact, it's probably a detriment to have a Ph.D. to be on the side of humanity and to be able to do stuff for humanity. You can take your wisdom and take your knowledge and bring it to the street with your neighbors and begin to form alliances and connections which are real democracy. And in doing that, and standing up to the powers that be in the process of doing it, which they very much did in you know, the Middle East, North Africa, and now in Spain and Greece, you demonstrate both a courage and a commitment and a wisdom that other people realize. I mean, you know, look, somebody sitting in Iowa, they could say to themselves, well, the Egyptians are genetically superior to us. The Egyptians are more confident than us. They're more courageous than us. They're smarter than us. But that's silly. I mean, that's just silly. And so nobody thinks that. What they begin to realize is, wait a second, the Egyptians, now the Spaniards, the Greeks, all that distinguishes them from us is that they got up and tried. And so now we have to do it too. And so it starts to spread.
Michael, in particular, when we look at Spain, there's a set of demands accompanied by sort of a conscious expulsion of political parties and political party affiliated labor unions to take it out of the realm of the status quo politics of Spain, because there's a sense among these protesters that the current structure does not work, and that to allow these players from the the current, the status quo to enter into their movement would somehow damage it. Are these people dreaming of a new future that is realistic, idealistic? Is it attainable? What do you think can come out of this in Spain and some of these other countries where people are realizing that the current structure no longer works?
Maybe you remember, I think it was 2 years ago now, when there were huge uprisings in Greece. They weren't reported well enough to get a good feeling of it, but estimates were that 40% of the population had gone into the streets at various moments in those uprisings, similar to what we're seeing now. And now it's happening again in Greece. And when that happened the first time, it was incredibly interesting because it got to the point where these massive movements in the street, there was really only one thing left to do. They had taken over buildings and factories, and the only thing left to do was to occupy the equivalent of, you know, our White House and our Congress. I mean, that was the next step. And the movement at that point realized something that was very daunting. It was that they didn't know what they wanted to replace the system with. They knew that the system was horrible. They knew that it was corrupt. They knew exactly what you're describing. It isn't just the people, but the positions that people hold, owners, bosses, magistrates, heads of companies and corporations and political bureaucracies, these positions compel people and mold people to behave in ways that is horrendously harmful. Everybody knows this. There's nothing brilliant about that. Everybody knows nowadays. Okay, so the Greeks knew that, and nowadays, and this time around, the Spaniards know it, and the Greeks know it. What isn't as strong, what isn't as coherent, I think, is an understanding or a clarity about what to do, what to produce, what to create, what new structures can accomplish the functions of society, can accomplish production and consumption and allocation, can accomplish legislation, can accomplish socialization and bringing up kids and on and on and on. What new structures can accomplish these things, these functions, without imposing on the population horrible hierarchies that empower and enrich a few at the expense of everybody else? What can do that? That's weak. The answers to that question, I think they exist, but they're not widely shared yet. So in a very real sense, I think what's happening in Spain and what's happening in Greece needs to lead to that. If it doesn't lead to coherence about where to go and what steps to try to take, however haltingly and fittingly, then eventually it will get tired and it will get worn down and it will go back again. And then later on it will resurge. That's what we're going to see for a while now, while people begin to develop that clarity. In Egypt, in North Africa, in the Middle East, there was clarity because the aim was simply, let's get rid of dictators. Let's get rid of, you know, this barbaric form of political organization. So that was clear, and people knew more or less what you replace it with to take a step forward. But they also, at a deeper level, realized that attaining what we have, say, in the U.S. or in parts of Europe, gives you what you have in the U.S. and parts of Europe. A society that isn't a dictatorship, but is very, very, very far from being truly humane, caring, solidaritous, and so on. And so those movements, too, are moving beyond those initial demands. To the extent that that can happen, you ask, is it hopeless or is it utopian? It's hopeless if it has no vision. You can't build a big structure without, not necessarily a blueprint, but at least a coherent picture of what it is you're trying to do, so that your steps and your efforts and your activities actually lead where you're trying to go. So that's needed. So without that, until we have that, it's not yet fundamentally on the road to something better. That's clearly the case. And as of now, people are still working toward that. I mean, there are instances of it around the world, instances of people who put forth ideas, but they need to spread, and they need to be shared, And once they are, then I think we'll see that it's very, very possible. That in the same way it's possible to overthrow a dictator relatively quickly, once you're coherent and you're committed and you know what you're doing, it's also possible to overthrow what's called capitalism and to overthrow what's called, you know, parliamentarianism or electoral democracy or whatever you want to call the kinds of systems that exist. Basically, elitist systems in which a relatively small sector of the population decides everything for everybody else. It's possible to overcome all that, too, once you know where you're going.
I think that's good, excellent analysis in terms of the recognition of the problem is there, the anger is there, the rage is there, the blueprint is not there yet. What lessons, Michael Albert, can we learn from the very hopeful time and the remarkable coalitions that developed in the streets of Paris in 1968? Of course, we have a lot of, you know, flying around. We have a lot of comparisons to you know, 1968 in Paris related to Greece and Spain and places like that. What can we learn from Paris?
Well, you know, the difference is, I think, in those days, and I was very active in those days, the upsurges that happened all through the 60s were a function of people feeling like they'd been lied to in a very real sense. In other words, some blinders came off, and we looked around and we saw, oh my gosh, you know, the U.S., let's take the U.S., or in France, isn't the country we thought it was. It isn't motivated in the humane and caring ways that we thought it was. The various institutions in it aren't all trying to make people's lives better. People began to understand profit and power and to began to see how society was criminal, how society was organized to the interests of a few. And we went berserk. We were furious. And that drove us out into the streets, that anger. Nowadays, if you look at the U.S., there's nothing you can tell anybody that surprises them. When we found out about the Vietnam War, we were shocked. When we found out about the situation of blacks in the South, we were shocked. When people understood that, when women sat around and talked about their situation and discovered this thing called patriarchy that was systemic, they were shocked. Nowadays, no one is shocked by anything because everybody knows everything is broken. And what holds the system in place is not, you know, confusion about it being okay. What holds the system in place is confusion about the possibility that there's anything better. A feeling of despair. Margaret Thatcher's "There Is No Alternative." That's what keeps things going as they are. That kind of hopelessness, of lack of will to change it because it seems like a hopeless task. If you look at the Argentine example that I mentioned earlier, it is very instructive, far beyond, I think, those much earlier events. So in Argentina, hundreds and hundreds of factories were occupied by workers who were doing what? Well, the economy was in crisis. Owners and managers and engineers basically were leaving these moribund factories. And workers didn't want to use their jobs, so they took them over. And the barely educated workforce, that was the case in Argentina, took over these factories. And over a period of months, they had to make them operate, these factories that were failing. And they did. And they had to make the factories successful. And they did. So they learned quickly how to do things. I sat with a woman who was doing the financial accounting for a glass factory, and she had been working in the factory, you know, in front of the hot oven all day long, totally tedious, absolutely debilitating, you know, just incredible. And so the factory is taken over by the workforce, and she becomes the financial person as well as doing other kinds of work, and she does it successfully. And I asked her, well, what was the hardest thing to learn? After all, you weren't very educated, and now you're doing the job, you know, of these highly educated folks who were doing the finances. What was the hardest thing to learn? She didn't want to answer. And I kept pushing, and I said, well, okay, was the hardest thing to learn you know, the computers, using the computers and the software. She said, no. I said, well, was the hardest thing to learn, the accounting, the systems of accounting and the concepts that are associated. She said, no. And I said, well, I don't get it. What was the hardest thing to learn? And she said, well, first I had to learn to read. Then I did those other things. And what that tells you is that working people are capable of running society. That the only reason that they don't is because society is structured in such a way that they are denied the feeling of confidence and the skill and the knowledge with which they could run society. And so what happened in Argentina was remarkable, but here's the punchline. It ran out of steam. Why? Because in that factory that they took over, she became the new financial officer. And as a result, over time, and this is the way they described it, all the old rot came back. That's the way they described it. The alienation and the hostility and the competitiveness inside the workplace returned. And so the morale and the energy dissipated. Why did it happen? Well, it happened because they didn't realize that you had to not only have her do empowered work, but have everybody in the workplace do a fair share of empowered work, so that everybody in the workplace could have a fair say over the operations of the whole workplace instead of enshrining a new elite. And that kind of lesson, that kind of understanding of, okay, what do we have to do to change, in this case, the old division of labor? In another case, different things. What do we have to do to change the old key institutions so that we won't reproduce the ills of the past? It isn't just bad people. It isn't even primarily bad people. In fact, it's barely bad people at all. It's bad structures. It's structures that compel these outcomes. So if the people of Spain rise up and start to occupy factories and occupy neighborhoods, and they are tremendously energetic, and they are you know, effusive and spirited, but over time they don't change the institutions, then it will revert. Same thing for Egypt, same thing for Greece, same thing for here. But if they understand what institutions, what key institutions need to be changed and in what direction, then it will persist. Okay, so that's the problem of vision and implementing vision. And if we do that, and it wasn't done in the 60s, it wasn't done in France, it hasn't been done since, although there are places on the planet where people are trying to do variants of this in a very different context, but that's what needs to be done.
Well, Michael, thank you for being here and talking about this. We only just have a minute or two left, and this may be unfair, but I just want to gauge your optimism. You've been at this quite a while, reimagining new political and economic structures. Your book, Paracon, Life After Capitalism, Participatory Economics, is something you've talked about, written about, and done a lot of work on. Do you see similar signs of people looking for alternatives, trying to reimagine a future where we could actually put together a blueprint where there'll be some alternatives that are workable or pragmatic?
Yes, even if I didn't, I'd still be optimistic, because history is long. And if we keep working and we keep functioning, you lose, you lose, you lose, you win. And you only have to win real liberty and real participation once. So my answer is I'd still be. But actually, in answer to your question, yes, at the moment I see tremendous potential. I think if Joe Hill, you know, an American organizer, came back tomorrow, he would look around and he would say, oh my gosh, this country is like, you know, an organizer's dream. Everybody understands that the basic institutions are corrupt and rotten and serve only narrow interests. Everybody gets that. Nobody even denies it. All of popular culture is full of novels and movies which show it. And he would say, in that context, with people's anger and with people's pain, it ought to be easy to organize people. Now, he'd be wrong, because that optical of hopelessness and cynicism is a hard one to overcome. But over the past few years, and at an escalating rate, I think it is beginning to get chipped away, and it is beginning to dissipate, and people are beginning to think positively rather than just bemoan their pain. And I don't think it takes long. Once you sort of turn a corner, and once people's mindset starts to shift, the speed with which it's possible for a new attitude to overtake large sectors of the population and lead to activity will be quite striking.
Well, on that hopeful note, I appreciate you being here with us tonight, Michael Albert, and you can certainly leave the information about how people can get in touch with Z Magazine for subscription information, certainly become a participating member of ZNet, and you've got your Z Media Institute coming up real soon, this week, right?
Yeah, well, that's closed out because people apply for that. But the easiest thing to do, and rather than lots of examples, the easiest thing to do is to go to www.zcommunications.org. Z, and then the word communications, all one word, Z Communications. And at that site, pretty much everything is represented. So you can see the videos, you can see the print magazine that's a monthly, you can see the website and so on and so forth, and it's easy to begin to participate and to relate to the content.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being here, Michael, and I hope we can call upon you again to talk about the progress of history here. Thanks.
Sure. I'd love to. Thank you very much for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Michael Albert, co-founder of Z Magazine and South End Press, and again, zcommunications.org is a place where you can find out about what's going on there.